From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Time for the curtain to fall, take a bow, and always leave them wanting more. Words are all that I have to give. This is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. On a macroscopic level, those of us who try to remain calm and rational and who try to win hearts and minds over to our own way of thinking through discussion and persuasion, are at a distinct disadvantage compared to those who are loud, obnoxious, or intimidating in their approach. Regardless of what your view is on any given issue encounter in life, if you're like me, you've at times sensed a profound frustration in apparently not being able to win people over to your side, no matter how passionately and eloquently you put forth your case, how rational your arguments seem to be, and how obvious the facts of the matter seem to be to you. Clearly, reasonable people can differ, but that only explains very few cases in which I reached an impasse with anyone holding a conflicting opinion. In discussing any matter at all, you may feel that you have a solid, rational, and unassailable argument, and that it can only be a matter of time before your opinion wins the day. Yet still, time and time again, in the field of politics, of economics, of ethics, or even in just practical everyday living, people continue to support ideas that are demonstrably irrational, and you may be pulling your hair out, literally or figuratively, to find out that your message is just not coming across. Well, it took me decades before I figured it out for myself, but in the end, I found the reason why rational arguments seem to run like water off a duck's back on the people around me. Firstly, we need to keep in mind that a very great number of people around, perhaps even most people, do not hold a single sincere opinion of their own. Rather, they simply repeat the parrot calls of what they hear, for instance, on the news. You know, the news, that form of entertainment, passing itself off as useful information, and making its insignificant consumers feel important by convincing them that it's so vital that they personally know all about dozens of critically important issues in the world which they have no power to control or change. So many people you know will confuse keeping up with the news for actual understanding, and subsequently confuse what they have been told over and over again and what they've learned to repeat for a genuine personal opinion. Now, lest I sound aloof or supercilious, I acknowledge that some people do understand more than others, and I do not minimize anyone's genuine passions or deeply held convictions in any field, be it political, social, aesthetic, or metaphysical. However, what I did finally discover was the reason behind this enormous inertia I had overcome when merely addressing arguments rationally. It's not even that so many people are generally irrational, as I concluded at first, but rather that they do not cling to ideas because they're rational, they cling to ideas because they're comfortable. At this point in my life as well, I need to acknowledge the mistakes I once made by forcing people into discussions that I thought were pressing and urgent, when those others were likely not eager to talk about them. In reflection, it was probably not such a hot idea as a 15-year-old kid for me to bring up topics like censorship, wealth redistribution, unionized labor, or compulsory education at the dinner table, or at the campground on weekends, at barbecues, or when my family had get-togethers with other friends, and force certain topics on people who certainly never gave such matters as much thought as I had, and did not find them so urgent and never did form sincere opinions of their own. And then for me to conclude that everyone was just irrational, for not voicing 100% agreement with me right on the spot. I know better now, Still, reflecting on that time and considering it in a new light has allowed me to notice just what the real source of my frustration with those around me really was. It did not matter what issue I wanted to discuss, the fact was simply that the rank and file of those I knew were all very comfortable in their station in life and under the social order in which they lived. In forcing people around to confront the rational or moral faults in their system they for so long had taken for granted, I was disrupting their comfort. And why shouldn't they have been comfortable? They had nothing to gain by being overly philosophical about it. What, no compulsory education? Where would they find babysitters for their kids while they were at work? Censorship? Oh, well, nothing they wanted to say landed them in jail, and by and large, the only things that were banned in the country were things they didn't like anyway. Taxation? Yeah, it was too much, but they still lived well, better than most people elsewhere in the world. Socialized medicine? Who cares if it falls apart one day? Right now, it's a good feeling to know that they never pay doctor's bills. Gun control? Well, of course, did they want their country to get as bad as the States? Nothing I could say. No amount of rational argument could sway anyone. The most generous response I got was, "I see your point." Then again, why should I have swayed anyone? Rational argument has nothing to offer people who are comfortable with the status quo. The social order in which they lived offered them a profound level of normalcy. Ayn Rand once opined that if a pro-freedom movement ever forms anywhere, the process of liberating a country from within will be faster than was the process by which that country became unfree, simply because freedom has rationality on its side. As much as I support her philosophy in general, on this point, I emphatically disagree. The desire for normalcy, a sense of serenity in the immediate term, is a powerful drive in most people, and they will pay tremendous prices, and often at the cost of greater problems in the future, simply to have peace and quiet in the given moment. This is something against which those of us advocating freedom have no weapon. Reason and rationality may be on the side of freedom, but that does not mean that the people are on the side of freedom. And this is why those of us seeking to establish a free society are at a distinct disadvantage compared to those who continue to destroy what freedom is left in the West. I absolutely hate to say it, but I have to thank the late William Pierce for making this point clear to me via his novel, The Turner Diaries. Now, those who are familiar with the book or with the late Dr. Pierce, I'll ask you not to turn the dial in disgust just yet. For those who are not familiar with him, Dr. William Pierce was the founder of the White Racist National Alliance and the author of the Turner Diaries, which he wrote under his pen name, Andrew MacDonald. The story is a fictional portrayal of how a small group of white nationalists take over the United States and set out to exterminate all people of color first and foremost, but also gays and, wouldn't you know it, the Jews. As a novel, it's quite an exciting action story. I grant him that, but as far as literary merit is concerned, it's not especially well written, though I have certainly read worse, even in English, definitely worse in Swedish. The program outlined in the message being conveyed in the novel is absolutely disgusting, and while leftist outlets like the Southern Poverty Law Center called it the Bible of the Racist Right, the program offered in the book is grossly socialistic, as was William Pierce, as the individual, preferably white individual, in everything he did had first and foremost to advance the cause of his collective, in this case, the white race, while his individual ambitions and desires were a second priority. It was socialistic, but it simply raised the question of defining who it was that comprised the social unit. In this case, it was the white race, whom Pierce identified as a nation. Thus, it was national socialist, entailing everything that term implies. Of course, racism by definition is collectivistic. It's perhaps the most rudimentary and unsophisticated form of collectivism, whereas I advocate individualism. So you'll understand why I'm loath to give the Turner Diaries any credit at all. Still, there's no denying that deep within all the filth and muck contained in that novel, I did find a gem. which helped me to understand the widespread desire for normalcy and how the enemies of freedom exploit it. The enemies of freedom, and quite frankly advocates of freedom, need to understand that in order to gain popular support, they need to convince the masses that normalcy will be restored once they get their way and their agenda is advanced. Rational argument and winning people over intellectually is the hard way. That is why generally enemies of freedom resort to such things as name-calling and ridicule, as well as demonstrations, boycotts, and even violence in order to advance their agendas. They lack any rational arguments, and besides, those are far less effective anyway. What is important to remember is that, at first, any social movement that wants to upset the apple cart will be despised at first, exactly because it's upsetting the apple cart, making waves, disturbing the normalcy that people enjoy. However, given enough time and persistence, the people will become tired of having the serenity in their lives upset, and then eventually give in to the demands of the agitators in order to restore normalcy. This is exactly the same process by which a child who is not disciplined by his parents as he grows up becomes a bully or a delinquent. It works. And of course, by giving in on one occasion, you may regain normalcy for the immediate moment, but by having demonstrated that intimidation works, it's not long before you're faced with a new irrational demand made by the same people using the same tactics in order to disrupt the normalcy until such time as the new demands are met. It happens in increments, slow, steady degrees. Now, you might have heard about the frog in a pot of boiling water. It's an oft-repeated metaphor. Now, please do not actually try this rather cruel experiment, but apparently, if you were to drop a frog into a pot of boiling water, the frog would react to the dangerous hot water right away and try to hop out and escape. However, if you were to place a frog in a pot of cold water and then slowly heat the water very gradually, the frog will never notice the increase in temperature and would eventually boil to death as it sat in the bottom of the pot. That metaphor is used to illustrate how it's possible that we do not notice even the most drastic changes if they are made gradually. This principle has been successfully applied, for instance, by the gay lobby. Now, if I lately seem to be picking on the gay lobby, it's simply because I find they are picking on everyone else, and I'm tired of it. I shouldn't have to say it, but lest people read into what I say things I don't mean. While I don't approve of the behavior, what gay people get up to in private is their own business as far as I'm concerned. I don't think it makes them bad people, and I don't hold it against them. So while I have no problem with gay people, the gay lobby seems to have a problem with me. The problem they have with me is the fact that I don't share in the same collective amnesia that it seems mainstream society has suffered for the past 30 years. We are those frogs that have not noticed the pot getting hot as the gay lobby has advanced its agenda. However, those of you who are old enough to remember 30 years ago, consider this. What if someone from our time now could travel back and meet you back then? Would you have believed anyone who told you that by 2013, two people of the same sex would be getting married in many parts of the world? Would you believe that the common wisdom would be that there was nothing wrong with homosexuality, that it would become illegal for homosexuals to seek out psychiatric help for it, and illegal for psychiatrists to offer treatment, even if homosexuals themselves, who were troubled by their proclivity, actively sought help to deal with it? Would you believe that a time would come when it would not be enough for you simply to tolerate homosexuals, but if you did not support their political campaigns, then you were an evil bigot, not just wrong in your opinion, but morally evil? Would you believe that while it was found that there was nothing wrong with homosexuality, those who felt an aversion to homosexuality would be considered to suffer from a psychosis, given a clinical name, homophobia, and that they should be cured of it? Do you remember the TV show Three's Company, a little more than 30 years ago now? One of the running jokes was that one character, Jack, had to pretend to be gay in order for the landlord to allow him to share the flat with two young women. This made for a lot of jokes and gags that were apparent to adults, but children could watch the show too without danger of being exposed to anything obscene. The double entendres were over the kids' heads. Well, for most kids anyway. There's a reason why I remember, after all. I wonder if the gay lobby has commented on Three's Company. I'm certain that Three's Company would never be produced today, and that's even without the gay lobby having to do anything. The mere fear of a reaction on the part of the gay lobby would cause the TV producers to tread lightly. And that, in a nutshell, is when you know you've won the battle, when other people fear you and do your bidding without you even having to tell them. So you want to resort to rational argument? How more compelling is your argument than the fear generated by your opponent? It can be fear of violence, but fear of any negative consequences typically far weightier than even the best-formed arguments. There is a reason why an obscene art installation of a crucifix in a jar of urine or paintings of Christ in a homosexual setting are displayed in public, but images of Muhammad are not. There's a reason why religious Christians are portrayed as quaint and ignorant in the mainstream media, but homosexuals are not portrayed as degenerate perverts. There's a reason why in advertisements depicting both men and women, the woman is always made out to be smarter and the man incompetent, even in ads for such things as power tools and paint sprayers and other things typically considered the province of men. For that matter, there's a reason why sitcoms typically show a capable, clever, and determined mother while the father is an inarticulate goofball. Quite simply, in all those cases, the targets of the jokes are not likely to strike back in any way. Consider the most demonized party in any media story, and you'll see who the media truly understands poses no threat or danger. There's a reason why the Swedish paper Aftonbladet today roundly condemns the United States and Israel no matter what they do, but never criticized Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, and today has voluntarily taken on the role as an apologist for Iran. The point is this: nobody who truly poses a threat to the serenity, to the normalcy of mainstream society, will be attacked. Now, if that fact be turned into something positive, it may be a useful tool in the establishment of freedom.
As white as the lily flower, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ to be our sweet Savior. As red as any blood, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ to do poor sinners good. The holly bears a prickle as sharp as any thorn, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ on Christmas Day in the morn.
siren and the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, sweet singing in the choir.
Yes, even I do get into the Christmas spirit and enjoy a few carols at this time of the year. That was Roger Whittaker singing The Holly and the Ivy. I've long thought that that melody, the melody to Holly and the Ivy, would make a good national anthem. Now, a lobby, any lobby, is just an interest group. While they can be intimidating or even influential in a positive way, any power they exert over other people necessarily comes through the exercising of the power of the state. Why does the state give in to the demands of lobby groups, even if the demands made often represent the views of a small minority of the country, even in the face of general opposition? The answer is that the lobby is louder, more obnoxious, and threatening. This is obvious in cases of very crude examples, such as when speakers on college campuses are shouted down off stage and then the college administration does not react to defend the speaker, but rather forbids the speaker from returning. You see, normalcy and serenity are more easily restored by surrendering to the hooligans. Standing up for freedom of speech and taking measures to prevent such trespass involves a lot more work. And then furthermore, if the college ever were to remove an unruly mob by bringing in security men or the police to drag them out, photographs of the incident would be all over the newspapers, along with all the editorial comments about the hard-handedness of the college administration. It's much easier just simply to cancel the speaking engagement of whatever conservative, Christian, objectivist, or otherwise non-leftist, exactly because conservatives, Christians, objectivists, and other non-leftists are typically not likely to resort to violence or to any other reprisals for having their speeches cancelled. Furthermore, the college administration, by cancelling speeches, can turn the case around and come out smelling like a rose by issuing a press statement after the fact, in which they can claim that, for the safety of students and the general moral tone of the college campus, the administration chose to follow a course of weighted caution and cancel an engagement that would likely be inflammatory and may result in an incident which the college does not have the resources to combat, blah, 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 blah. It's much easier to give out such a press statement once than it is to respond to countless telephone calls from various media outlets asking for an explanation why the college resorted to physical violence against a bunch of kids who were exercising their democratic right of peaceful protest. Sure, peaceful. It wasn't the kids with the batons now, was it? However, lobbies also manifest themselves in subtler ways, such as in the form of voting blocks. As the population of the Western countries ages, old age pensioners continue to form a larger and larger single voting bloc. Now, in Sweden, this voting bloc is by far the most socialistic in its opinion. However, in the English-speaking countries, the political views are more nuanced overall, yet there are large segments within it that hold to traditional Anglo-Saxon values, including the Christian ethics, the rights of private property, and gun ownership. They also hold generally conservative values in terms of personal liberties, not being so open to ideas such as lifting the prohibition on drugs or abolishing censorship altogether. Again, opinions differ from one person to another within this voting bloc, but generally a political candidate running on such a broadly conservative platform will find considerable support within this demographic. However, he must be careful not to upset the normalcy that his constituents enjoy. He may, by power of persuasion, win over the old age pensioners onto his side on every single issue, but then if he goes further and suggests that things like Medicare or Social Security be privatized or abolished, he will lose so much of his support that it will likely cost him an election. And under a de facto two-party system, the man who will win the election will be the liberal opponent who may support gay marriage, abortion, drug decriminalization, lighter sentences for criminals, environmental legislation, and an entire host of policies that are traditionally anathema to conservatives and old-age pensioners in general. You see, rational arguments, principles, and even sincerely held moral values are less compelling than maintaining normalcy and serenity in the given moment. And then we get all bent out of shape about when sitting politicians don't represent the views of the electorate. Go figure. Listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. And that was a traditional Swedish Christmas carol, a pretty song that every Swede knows, called Glans över sjö och strand, which means roughly, shine over sea and shore, star in the distance. The lyrics are as beautiful as the song itself. Sadly, they are, of course, lost in translation, as it were. Keeping in mind that the desire for normalcy in the given moment is a powerful human drive, how can it be used to one's advantage in a positive way in attaining freedom and in limiting the extent of the heavy hand of the powers of be hold over us? Those people in government, not just the elected officials, but the bureaucracy, especially the bureaucracy, are just as inclined to normalcy as anyone else. I quite seriously wonder whether or not the bureaucrats would make half the decisions they do if they feared any reprisals. Of course, one reprisal against an elected official is for the electorate to vote him out at the next election. I acknowledge that as a matter of procedure, but it would be simply blind and naive to think that the electoral process has done anything to halt the erosion of personal freedom. Every single freedom we once had, and which has now been taken away, has been lost through the democratic process. And worse still, the bureaucrats that execute the legislation are not nearly as susceptible to elections, for obvious reasons, and they can make most decisions with impunity. What if, instead, each time they sent a letter, made a telephone call, or issued an order, they stopped for a few seconds to think about how the recipient would react, who might be offended, and what reprisals might come about? I've mentioned before that in Sweden, like most other European countries, there's a legal requirement for anyone owning a television receiver to pay a yearly license fee of about $400. The license fee goes to pay for the nominally independent public service television stations, in reality two socialist brainwashing channels, and loyal service to the Social Democratic Workers' Party. It doesn't matter that you likely never watch those channels, as there are plenty of private ones that are more appealing. Simply owning a television set requires that you pay money to support a point of view you might not share. In order to ensure that licenses are paid, the radio service sends out inspectors who knock on doors of the people who are not registered as having paid the license, and to check to see if they can see any sign of a TV being in the house. The inspectors are not permitted to enter houses, even upon invitation of the resident. However, they are permitted to peek through windows. These inspectors are not paid salaries by the government to do such home visits, nor are they associated with the police or even the TV broadcast company. They're independent contractors that get a commission for every household they catch with a TV. Essentially, they are freelance finks. Every now and then a news story comes out about one TV inspector or another having been assaulted by a homeowner, and apparently an average of 5 TV license enforcement inspectors are assaulted in Sweden every year. I hope you don't find my comparison too drastic, but whenever I hear about the TV license enforcement people being assaulted, I think of Jeffrey Dahmer being murdered in prison. If you don't remember who Jeffrey Dahmer was, I'll leave it up to you to Google him. I don't want to talk about his ghoulish crimes right now. Suffice it to say that he was an unspeakably evil man who was sentenced to life in prison. He was eventually murdered. I remember thinking at that time that, sure, it was wrong that he was murdered, but he was such a scumbag, I couldn't bring myself to feel all that sad about it. Now, it might not be fair of me to compare the TV license enforcers to Jeffrey Dahmer, but my emotional response to hearing that a few of them get socked in the nose now and then is about the same. I don't rejoice in it at all. I understand it's wrong and shouldn't happen, but in a detached way, I cannot help but to feel that it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Of course, I cannot help but to consider how many people would ever choose to become TV license enforcers if the risk of being assaulted were very great. If someone in the service of the state could be certain of suffering reprisals for upholding an unjust law, how much longer could such a law be enforceable? How much longer could the state recruit finks to go out and do their dirty work for them? Now, I'm still very reluctant to resort to violence, but I'm open to the idea of shunning people in the community who are overt enemies of freedom. I'm all for printing the pictures and names of local collaborators and encouraging the entire community to stop dealing with them in any capacity at all. That'd be very effective in small towns, but perhaps not in large cities. There may be other ways. The bottom line is that in order for us to regain our freedom, we are not likely going merely to vote our way to it. We need to find ways of making violating individual freedom inimical to the serenity and normalcy in the lives of the men in power.
Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, throw cares away. Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold. Ding dong, ding dong, that is is their song. With joyful ring, all caroling, one seems to hear words of good cheer from everywhere, filling the air. Oh, how they pound, raising the sound for hill and dale, telling their tale. Gaily they ring while people sing song of good cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, 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 merry Christmas. Merry, 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 merry Christmas. On, on they send, on without end, their joyful tone to every home. Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all seem to say, throw cares away. Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold. Ding dong, ding dong, song with joyful ring, all caroling. One seems to hear words of good cheer from everywhere, filling the air. Oh, how they pound, raising the sound. Oh, hill and dale, telling their tale. Can hear the ring while people sing song of good cheer. Christmas is here. Merry, 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 merry Christmas. Merry, 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 merry Christmas. On they sing, on without end, their joyful tone to every home. Hark how the bells, sweet silver bells, all sing the same.
The desire for normal is natural, but it too easily becomes complacency and tends toward pragmatism. In the long run, we gradually lose any real normalcy that would be afforded to us through the safeguarding of our individual rights, freedom of choice, and personal independence, and the consequences of having placated those with nefarious intentions catch up to us. We become the frogs in the pot of hot water due to our pragmatic outlook. Now, pragmatism is a word that is widely misunderstood. That something is pragmatic is not the same as saying it's practical. Pragmatism is a philosophical train of thought that holds that one should serve the needs of the immediate moment without either addressing any principles involved or taking into account any future consequences. The consequences can be dealt with as they arise, and at that time, those consequences too should be addressed pragmatically. Pragmatists tend to hear a lot of "I told you so's." Pragmatism as such is the only original contribution to formal philosophy ever to come out of the United States, which is a shame as everything that made that country great is countered by pragmatism. The needs of the immediate moment, without regard for the long-term consequences, are often served by a phenomenon known as groupthink. In spite of the name, groupthink has nothing to do with thinking, but it's rather a deliberate abandonment of thinking. It occurs when a given group of people prioritize harmony and conformity so much that it leads to a deviant or erroneous decision being made. Truth, principles, and rationality are dispensed with in order to minimize conflict within the group. Consensus in and of itself becomes a value. Groups succumbing to groupthink are characterized by profound lack of critical evaluation and aversion to alternative viewpoints and isolating themselves from outside influences. It's considered disloyal for members of the group to raise controversial questions or even the slightest of unorthodox alternatives. As a result, there's a pronounced lack of personal creativity and independent thought. In time, the group suffers from a delusion of invulnerability, as it is never exposed to other ideas. Groupthink offers comfort not only in the normalcy that conformity offers, but by rationalizing such conformity as being right in itself. Those upsetting the conformity, those belonging to the out-group, become dehumanized. Dehumanizing the other only works and utterly depends on not meeting other people. Think of all the kinds of people that are dehumanized in our society, whether only in jest or in serious condemnations. Think of lawyers, bankers, or insurance people. We all have caricatures of all such people as being greedy or uncaring. Yet would you think that if you knew any? And then again, perhaps you do know some. Chances are that on an individual basis, you quite readily put a human face on such people when you know them personally. So what then, are the bankers, lawyers, and insurance people you know perfectly all right, while the rest are scoundrels? It's easy to dismiss someone as stupid, cruel, ignorant, or irrational when we don't know them personally, when they are not part of our in-group. So it's easy to dehumanize prominent people whose views are contrary to one's own. People who tend to get under other people's skin, such as the likes of Michael Moore, Ann Coulter, Jane Fonda, Sarah Palin, Thomas Friedman, Michelle Bachmann, or Barack Obama, we're quick to label them. While someone with whom we are personally familiar tends to be given much more latitude. We don't want to believe that those within our group are stupid, cruel, ignorant, or irrational, so we are more likely to accept that people simply have different opinions and that we can respectfully disagree with each other. Indeed, it need not even be as involved as in addressing different opinions. How we treat the in-group differently than the out-group can be seen in very straightforward encounters. Say you come out to a car park to get into your car, and you see that someone has parked his wide new Humvee next to you along the driver's side of your car, so closely that you can barely get into your car again. Your first reaction may be to think to yourself, "Oh, what kind of bonehead can be so oblivious as to where he parks? What kind of macho jerk drives a stupid Humvee anyway?" But then just as you manage to get into your driver's seat, you see the driver of the Humvee come out to the car park. It turns out to be a close friend of yours. You roll down your window to talk to him, and he tells you how his car is in the shop and he had to borrow his brother's Humvee. He apologizes for parking so close to the line, and he's still getting used to driving such a wide vehicle. In such a case, we suddenly forget that just a few seconds ago we were certain that the driver was some macho blockhead. In fact, in such a situation, we might even laugh it off and make a joke about it, once we see that we know the other driver. Same mistake on his part, same difficulty in you getting into your car, quite a different reaction depending on whether or not we know the other person involved. Thus, the divisive us-and-them phenomenon depends very much on people not getting to know each other. And this is why it's problematic that more and more these days, people don't know their own next-door neighbors. Once more, you're listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program for any reason, please send email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. My name's Paul Lambert. As mentioned before, this will be the last episode of VSI Radio International, at least for this year. Broadcasting on shortwave has been a great experience, however it is a lot of work, and I've gained considerable appreciation for those who have done it for years on end. Some people even an hour or more every day. However, in the coming year, I'll have many other personal and professional priorities, quite a few loose ends to tie up, which will not allow me the time to continue with VSI. Still, I cannot imagine being away forever, so keep an ear open for VSI on WBCQ again. Now, I've spoken with Alan Weiner at the station, and he has agreed to allow me to put up all 26 episodes of VSI on the WBCQ archives for you to listen to or to download at your leisure. As well, I'll finally make time to get my act together and fix up the VSI homepage and allow listeners to gain access to all the old programs, as well as a few ebooks and some other information. And as well, of course, the email, feedback@vsiradio.org, that will continue to be up for the foreseeable future. Starting next week, there'll be a new program on in the time slot vacated by VSI. The Next Chapter. That's what it's called, The Next Chapter. It's a show produced by Radio Alexandria, which looks like a very interesting radio project. It's based on a radio ship out in the Pacific Ocean. It too will be a program consisting largely of social commentary, but from what I gathered, it'll be very different from what you're used to hearing on VSI. So I, for one, will be listening to find out what it's all about, and I encourage you to listen as well. I wish Radio Alexandria and the next chapter all the best of luck in their radio endeavors.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 18 to 1. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas, I love you baby, I can see a better time when all our dreams come true. Christmas Day.
Before signing off one last time, a fellow WBCQ broadcaster wanted to get a word in here on VSI. Undoubtedly a familiar voice to many listeners to the station, Ramsey, hailing from Indiana, and host of the Monday night program Ramsey's Roadhouse, had a few reflections to share on the past season. As you'll hear, he certainly has a way with words.
Me. Yeah, there we go. Paul Lambert from deep in the forests of Sweden says, be a sovereign individual, almost pleading. Don't sit on that cradle-to-grave shelf when you can think and do for yourself. Then a life of true freedom you'll be leading. Okay, I'm going to do one more. Holy shit, man. Ramsey listens to VSI Wednesdays at 7. From the banks of the Tippecanoe, almost heaven. Paul's opinion is slanted to the right, but I can take it 1 hour, one night. Plus, I can turn into Brother Stare at 11. How about that, Paul? I'm a poet and didn't know it. All right. I just wanted to check in, like Alan Weiner says when he reads those emails on Friday night on his worldwide show here on WBCQ The Planet, 7490. Just want to let you know that we're compiling a Tippecanoe River Rat Dictionary here in the great state of Indiana, and we're going to put your picture, Paul, right next to our Ferner word. You'll have a big smile on your face. Colonel, I wanted to thank you for all your thought-provoking programs. You've given us a lot of hours of entertainment this last summer through the wonder of the electromagnetic broadcast world. Way over there in Monticello, Maine, your show comes across this nation, and 1,300 miles away strikes our little slinky antenna, and I think our tubes in our old pre-World War II radios glow just a little brighter when they hear your program fire up. All the best to you and yours from Carol and I here at the Tippecanoe River in the Roadhouse, Paul. Looking forward to next year, man. Good night.
Good night to you too, Ramsey, and all my love to Carol as well. I have a feeling that Ramsey will keep serving up the big boy and big girl radio down at the Roadhouse for some time to come. I encourage everyone to tune in on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern, 0000 hours UTC.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error. Soul felt its worth, a thrill of hope. The weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed listening to VSI Radio International as much as I've enjoyed broadcasting. Until our paths cross again, this is Paul Lambert wishing you all the very best and a very Merry Christmas to one and all.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.